from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
The Vatican has issued new norms on the approval of apparitions and other supernatural phenomena, indicating that dicastery of the doctrine of faith will provide greater oversight and transparency in the handling of these events. Register contributor Jimmy Akin provides his analysis of the new norms. Then we look at the complicated relationship of the Catholic Church and Communist China with Vatican journalist Frank Rocha. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Executive Director of the National Catholic Register and Catholic News Agency, and I'm your host. I'm joined by my co-host Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News. The head of the Dicastery of the Doctrine of the Faith, Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez, issued a new document titled Norms for Proceeding in the Discernment of Alleged Supernatural Phenomena. It replaces the old standard, which were approved by Pope St. Paul VI in 1978, and it was used for more than four decades, even though it was only published in 2011. We are going to be talking about the new norms with Jimmy Akin. Jimmy is a Catholic apologist, author, and podcaster for Catholic Answers. He's also a longtime contributor to the National Catholic Register. Jimmy, it's been such a long time since we've talked on Register Radio. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. I'm very pleased to be here, Jeanette.
So, Jimmy, today the question seems to be to believe or not to believe in these supernatural or alleged supernatural phenomena, things like Marian apparitions or even Eucharistic miracles, alleged Eucharistic miracles. So the underlying question that the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith takes up seems to be about whether these things are supernatural. So why the new norms? Why were new ones needed?
Well, alongside the new norms, Cardinal Fernandez has a kind of prefatory note where he explains the reasons for them, and he cites several of them. One reason was that previously there was not as much transparency about the role of the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, and that led to confusion. So now they're trying to be more upfront about exactly what they're doing and exactly what their role is and what they haven't said. Another problem is issue that led to the new norms is that previously judgments regarding apparitions tended to orient towards either saying this is definitely supernatural or this is definitely not supernatural, or there was kind of a middle judgment of we don't know if it's supernatural mm-hmm. or not. And what that did, according to Cardinal Fernandez, was it caused people to think, like if they said it's supernatural, that it caused the faithful to think they must believe it. And sometimes they'd even believe it more than the gospel. I mean, I'm sure we've all known people who have been much more excited and enthused about Marian apparitions than Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Right.
The church has always said, this is not obligatory. You do not have to believe this. This does not take priority over the gospel. And so they wanted to de-emphasize trying to discern, is it supernatural? Because people would confuse that with supernatural in the way the Bible is authoritative.
Right.
And so they wanted to introduce a more nuanced understanding of, you know, it can have actions of the Holy Spirit here, but that doesn't mean that it's pure, unalloyed truth or that it has no negative elements. And so they introduced a new system of six classifications, none of which are this is supernatural. That does still exist under the new norms, that this is supernatural classification, but it requires a special action of the Pope to declare that. Absent that special action, the highest of the new classifications is nihil obstat, which means nothing obstructs. We've got good evidence here for action of the Holy Spirit in connection with this event, and we haven't yet found any notable negative elements. But it's more flexible, and it can change over time. That's one of the things they stressed as well. A classification that applies at one time might not apply at another time.
Right. And so on that classification, the new one that you just, well, there's six new ones, but the one that they seem to kind of be pointing to the most is the nihil obstat. This is, nothing stands in the way, as you said, and that's what the Latin means. This is something that would then allow a bishop to be able to let that event, if you will, almost flourish on its own. It's not going to prevent anyone from going to that site or from looking at this devotion on their own. It's recognizing that it could be a private revelation and someone is able to believe in it. Others, though, of the six are a little bit more dissuasive. You know, some of them really say, no, this really shouldn't be promoted, and the bishop has to act in that way. Can you describe some of the more prohibitive stances?
Sure. So I'll walk through them right quick. The second one is pre oculis habeatur, which means it should be held before the eyes. And this is for phenomena that have important positive signs, but the bishop has also detected some negative signs, so he needs to keep an eye on it. A step down from that, number three, is curatur, which means it is to be attended to, and this is for phenomena that have significant critical elements, but nevertheless, they've spread widely. And I'll come back to this one just briefly because I have a thought about why this one exists. Mm-hmm. Basically, the bishop is encouraged not to promote the phenomenon, but to try to find ways to reorient it so that it's pastorally better for the people. Number four is submandato, which means under mandate. And this is one that's interesting because for this category, the phenomena itself is said to be rich in positive elements. So the phenomena itself is good, but it's being misused in some way. Like there's a group that's exploiting it for financial gain or defying the diocesan bishop or something like that. Number five is prohibitur et obstruatur, which means hindered and to be blocked. And this is for phenomena that have some positive elements, but big, serious, critical problems too. And basically, the bishop is to publicly declare that you're not to adhere to this, even though it has some positive elements. And then down at the bottom, number six is declaratio de non supernaturalitate, which means declaration of non-supernaturalness. This is not supernatural, folks. The show's over. Go home.
Right.
Jimmy, as we look at these six different categories, it's been noted by some analysts already that this does seem to place a lot of stress on the role of the dicastery going forward. Would you agree with that?
I think what it does is it highlights the role of the dicastery. It seems to me it's more a matter of transparency, because what happened under the 1978 norms was the bishop, the local bishop, was supposed to do an investigation and reach conclusions, but before he was allowed to report them, he had to go to the dicastery and say, here's what I did and here's what I concluded. Can I make this announcement? And the dicastery would say either yes or no, or they might launch a new investigation. But even if they approved what he was doing, they would say, but keep our name out of it. Don't tell people that we approved this. I assume the reason for that is they didn't want enthusiasts saying, oh, and the Vatican approved, implying that the Vatican did more than just review what the bishop did and say, yeah, that looks reasonable. So what the new norms do is they introduce more transparency so that when the bishop announces his results, it'll be tagged with the consent of the dicastery for the doctrine of the faith. So it makes its role more obvious, but it doesn't seem to me like they're taking notable new control over it in a hands-on manner.
Mm-hmm. This is Register Radio on EWTN. I'm talking to Jimmy Akin, and we're talking about the new norms for alleged apparitions or other supernatural events. And Jimmy, I'm most interested really in understanding, for those who have been devoted to particular apparitions, things like Fatima or mm-hmm. maybe even Medjugorje, or other events that have drawn their devotion. What does this do? The document doesn't actually mention any specific apparition.
Right. Not the norms don't. Cardinal Fernandez's introduction does, but the norms themselves don't. Well, this doesn't have any retroactive effects. So there's nothing in this saying we're reclassifying things from the past. They could in the future reclassify things, but for now, the declaration that Fatima was supernatural stands. They haven't done anything to change that. What is more interesting is Medjugorje, because this one has been very controversial. And during the reign of Pope Benedict XVI, the Pope commissioned the CDF, which is what the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith used to be called. He commissioned them to do a study of Medjugorje, and they went and they collected a bunch of data, and they did their analysis, and they submitted it to Pope Francis once he came into office, and we've heard nothing about this for years. And apparently, I mean, the rumor is, and this is just rumor, that they found significant problems with later Medjugorje apparitions, but some of the first ones they thought had more positive elements. And so it looked like we might be heading for a split decision, like some of the Medjugorje apparitions are legitimate and some of them not so much. But we've heard nothing for years. So it seems to me we're likely to finally get a ruling. And right. I suspect the ruling is number three. It makes sense if you've got a big worldwide controversial apparition that's hard to analyze with the existing criteria to revise the criteria, which is what they've now done. And so if you read down the list, based on what we know about what the CDF has done, it sounds like they're setting us up to finally give us a ruling on Medjugorje. And it sounds to me, my guess, I could be wrong, but my guess is they're gonna put it in number three, curator, which is for ones that have significant critical elements, meaning problems, but have nevertheless spread widely and are connected with verifiable spiritual fruits. And in this case, the bishop is not to encourage the phenomena, but to, quote, seek out alternative expressions of devotion and possibly reorient its spiritual and pastoral aspects. So that just sounds like
absolutely
what we know about Medjugorje in terms of what the CDF has thought.
Well, obviously, we're left with many more questions as we see how these norms are applied. We invite our listeners to go to ncregister.com. You can read the Catholic News Agency's story there about this. New norms give Vatican greater say on alleged apparitions, and you'll find analysis at ncregister.com as well. Jimmy, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
When we come back, Vatican journalist Frank Rocha will talk to us about the Catholic Church in China. This is Register Radio on EWTN. Stay tuned for more.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, your host here on Register Radio. I'm joined by my co-host, Matthew Bunsen. It's been 100 years since the Catholic Church's first council in China. And now, on May 21st, the Pontifical Urban University, along with Agencia Fides and the Pastoral Council for China, is holding a conference to discuss the 100-year history of the Church and China, as they also discuss contemporary Sino-Vatican relations. So today on Register Radio, we are joined by Vatican journalist Frank Rocha, who has covered the Vatican's relationship with China over the last 10 years. Frank, we are so grateful to have you.
Very glad to be here, Jeanette. Thank you. And Matthew.
So in this conversation, I mean, we're not going to go back to this 100 years. It would take much more than our segment on today's show. But we do want to have a conversation about where the Church and China is today. And in order to do that, we have to kind of recognize a reality that's existed on the ground for many years now. It's this reality of an official church and a so-called underground church. What is happening there?
Well, shortly after the Communist Revolution in China in 1949, the government and the party set up this Catholic Patriotic Association, basically a government-run church there. But there were some parts of the Catholic community that resisted that. They constituted the so-called underground church. We say so-called because they weren't literally, not only because they weren't literally underground, but because they were known to the authorities. They weren't usually secret, but they were sometimes tolerated, but it was a very precarious and remains a very precarious situation. And today, we don't know the exact proportions. It is said there are about 10 million Catholics in China, and the proportion of them in the so-called underground church is shrinking, has been shrinking, in part because the Vatican increasingly cooperates with the official church.
Right, and that's what we want to discuss today, really, are the increased relations between the Vatican and China. This has been, more than... It's been since 2018, I believe, that there's been this this agreement. And so you have seen, as you've covered the Vatican and China over these years, quite a bit of change in the relationship. What are some of the markers of the change in Vatican-China relations?
Well, yeah. In fact, one of the first big stories I covered when I started covering the Vatican in 2007 was Pope Benedict's open letter to the Catholics of China, in which he said, on the one hand, that the Catholic Church does not seek to overthrow the political system in China, but that it also said that Rome insists on its prerogative of choosing bishops in China. So there was a kind of cautious dialogue, rapprochement under Benedict. After there had been a lot of tension toward the end of John Paul's pontificate. Of Benedict, there was a kind of cautious, you know, attempt at dialogue. Under Francis, that's really accelerated, leading up to, of course, including the 2018 agreement that you mentioned on the selection of bishops, which the two sides agreed to select on bishops. And Francis has been very eager to have good relations with China.
Yeah, Frank, one of the overhanging realities of the China-Vatican deal is this process of sinicization, especially under Chinese Premier Xi Jinping. What does that exactly entail, and what are the threats for the church and for all religions in China?
Yeah, that's right. It's good that you mentioned, Matthew, that this applies. There are the five official religions that are approved in China, and Catholicism is one of them. But Xi Jinping especially, the term precedes him, but he's really made a big emphasis not only on religion, but China-fying everything. And now some people in the Vatican have compared this, likened this to enculturation, which we know about is a process of, you know, explaining the Catholic faith in the terms of the local culture and in worship, and we're all familiar with that to some extent. This is something that's very much more political, and it largely has to do with aligning yourself with the teachings of the Communist Party of China. So it's not just about Chinese traditional Chinese culture. So that's where a lot of the underground people are still very, very resistant.
That's right. And you mentioned, Frank, that the underground church is really shrinking. And in an article you wrote for The Atlantic just recently, it's titled "The Vatican's Gamble with Beijing is Costing China Catholics." You describe in that the underground church is really struggling in a sense, and yet there's a sort of lethargy, if you will, in the official church. What is happening in these two churches as one kind of constricts, at least visibly, and the other seems to just be getting by?
Yeah, there is a kind of paradox, as it was described to me. On the one hand, the Vatican has been encouraging underground bishops, underground clergy to join the official church to end this kind of split. So that on the one hand has bolstered the official church, but at the same and the underground church is very discouraged. I've been told, you know, it finds it hard to evangelize. It's more restricted. It's pressured by, it's under greater pressure from the state. But at the same time, I've been told there's a higher morale. There's a greater spirit of freedom, ironically, in their unfreedom among the underground. So one analyst I spoke to, Father Crivellaire of Asian News, who's somebody who knows China very well over the decades, he said he thinks the underground church won't disappear. It's still going to be around, and it will as long as there's a need for it. So, you know, someday there's religious freedom in China. Well, then, of course, there won't be an underground church anymore.
Of course, we pray for that, too, right? So we've been talking to Frank Rocha, who's a longtime Vatican journalist for The Wall Street Journal, and now he's joining EWTN. We're super grateful about that. And we're talking about the church in China. I'm going to pivot, though, for a minute to Matthew Bunsen. At the beginning, at the introduction, I mentioned this conference, Matthew, that's taking place next week on May 21st, and it's a conference that's looking at 100 years of history with the Vatican and China. What are, just very briefly, some key markers we should be aware of?
Yeah, one of the most important, I think, is that as we're looking at this anniversary, that there were two great objectives on the part of this great conference. And one, of course, was that decoupling of the missions from what they referred to as a colonial project. And then the other, and this is, I think, very connected to the conversation we're having with Frank, and that is about the indigenization of the Chinese church, finding converts within China. And it's always interesting to look at a council like this that brought together the church in China, and we look at how well-structured it was, knowing what was coming so soon after with the Chinese takeover of all of the enterprises, but especially the rise of communism, and then, of course, the terror of World War II, and then Mao Zedong. So, Frank, from your standpoint, a conference like this is important. Why? What is it that we hope to get out of this?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, there's going to be there's a session. One scholar from China is going to talk about sinicization, and so that will be interesting to see if they tries to explain to what extent it's compatible with enculturation from the Catholic side. Very simple significance of this conference is that the Bishop of Shanghai, who's the head of the basically head of the Patriotic Church, of the official church, is actually supposed to attend. And he's going to be speaking alongside Cardinal Parolin, the Vatican Secretary of State, and Cardinal Tagle, the head of the Vatican Missionary Office. And that's very significant for a couple of reasons. One, that if the Chinese let him come, because that's not a given. And until it happens, organizers have said, well, you know, let's hope it happens. And the other is, of course, that he's going to be sharing a platform with these, you know, very high leaders. And Pope Francis himself is giving a video greeting to the gathering, and will presumably meet the Bishop of Shanghai. We have to assume that if he's coming all the way to Rome, he's not going to not meet the Pope. So this will cause, no doubt, some distress to the underground community, or some of it, because it's another layer of approval of what's going on. And the Bishop of Shanghai, Bishop Shen Bin, is a very avid proponent of sinicization. He's even said, he said it to an official Chinese news organ last year. He said that the part of that means interpreting Catholic doctrine and Catholic theology in a way that aligns with core socialist values. So he's very eager to get along with the government there. And so that's an interesting point of attention.
Is this reminiscent in any way of the participation of some of the Chinese bishops, especially in the Synod on Synodality last October, and then some of the odd things that seemed to follow with their abrupt departure?
Yeah, there were some bishops that came, and to an earlier synod too, there were a pair of Chinese bishops. I think it was the one on youth, if I'm not mistaken. And they weren't allowed to stay for the whole session, or at least it was said that they had to go back for pastoral reasons. But whatever, they weren't there for the whole time. But I believe they did meet the Pope this time. And they spoke to a Vatican media organ. Certainly they didn't speak to the press at large. And I would be very surprised if Bishop Shen Bin talks to reporters, although we'll, of course, be eager to talk to him.
You know, Frank, I mean, we're talking about all of these restrictions. We have restrictions on bishops and what they can and can't do. We have restrictions on youth and how youth can be educated in the Catholic faith. They have to register and things like that to attend Mass and other liturgical events. It's quite a bit of restriction. And I know we don't have time to get very deeply in this, and your article at The Atlantic does, but this, though, the Pope sees this agreement as something positive, and it kind of reflects the larger realities of his pontificate in some ways, and you've written about that. If you could just briefly tell us, what is his aim?
Yeah, well, the Pope has been pretty sanguine about it. I mean, some of the Archbishop Gallagher is the equivalent of a foreign minister, has been a little more sober in saying it's not, it's the best deal we could get. It wasn't great. I think the Pope, I mean, you know, a couple of things that are particular about this Pope. One is that he is very emphasizes dialogue with the non-Catholic world broadly. Let's say, you know, whether that's Islam or whether in this case it's an atheistic regime, which he wants dialogue over confrontation. So there's certainly that. And another element I think that's important is his geopolitics, are multipolar. He's not, as someone said of an earlier pope, the chaplain of the West. He's not. You can see that also in the case of the war in Ukraine. You know, he said statements that shows that he sees it from Russia's point of view. You know, he sees that, he thinks that maybe Russia was provoked by the expansion of NATO. So, it's a surprise, I think, to many Americans, right and left, to the extent to which, you know, people in the Vatican or around the Vatican or in other parts of the church in the world see China, you know, as not necessarily a malign force and maybe a useful counterweight to U.S. dominance. There's a lot of that. To an extent that perhaps for us Americans is surprising.
Well, Frank, thank you so much for joining us here on Register Radio.
Thank you.
So you can find Frank Rocha, who's a longtime Vatican journalist for the Wall Street Journal, who's now joining EWTN as a senior Vatican analyst. You can find his work at The Atlantic. He just wrote an article on China and the Vatican. It's titled, "The Vatican's Gamble with Beijing is Costing China's Catholics." Thank you for joining us here on Register Radio. I'm Jeanette DeMello. I'm together with Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Ace McKay. I pray God bless you. Until next week.